This is Scott Richmond.
And Arnie Sherman.
You're listening to What Do You Know on News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM. Arnie Sherman, a good Sunday morning. Welcome back.
This week we have Tino Sonora, professor of finance from the College of Business, University of Montana, who quarterly comes and joins us to sort all of that out. And there's a ton of stuff to sort out. I mean, we have issues related to, possible recession, tariffs, and what's going on with tariffs. Changes every day. You know, how's Montana doing in the midst of all this? You know, some of the consequences of tariffs is people not caring as much about the United States anymore. We're losing tourists.
Scary.
You know, and Montana relies a lot on international tourists, particularly from Canada, to come here along the border areas, are feeling the effect already. Inflation, all of these kinds of issues that almost every day there's some kind of story about. I don't think I can remember a time where economic issues dominated the headlines as much as they do now.
Right.
And it's primarily because the man in charge has a different perspective on how to wield economic power from the Oval Office. And it's very, indiscriminate in many ways.
In service of what, Arnie?
You know, it's hard to say. privately, I have my own thoughts about in service of what. But, it is a new way for the presidency to operate. I mean, not only in the economic realm by creating, instead of measured and managed ways of creating economic policy or taxing industries or a particular company that is, doing something egregious. We're doing this broad-based across the board. We're going to tax this every country 20%. Our tariff rates were 3.3%. And as somebody who's done economic and international trade my whole life, I thought we got the better of the deal most of the time. But apparently, according to the current administration, we haven't.
Right.
But he also, because of his wielding of power that's unprecedented, he's dabbling in other things like demanding that the Washington Commanders change their name back to Redskins, or else he's not going to give them money to build a new stadium. I mean, that's unheard of, unprecedented. I don't know if any other president could get away with that.
Distractions, Arnie, distractions. These are all distractions.
But it's pretty creative distractions. I can't imagine anybody, George Bush, Ronald Reagan, Adlai Stevenson, John Kennedy, anybody, going in there and saying, if this team doesn't change their name back to the name I like, then I'm not going to approve a bond levy. I'm not going to let them get any money to build a new stadium. I mean, that would have been,
unheard of.
Yes, never discussed.
Well, they also don't have their own cryptocurrency, and they don't have other means of profiting off of the presidency.
They don't have their own cologne.
Right. They don't have their own cologne, steak, Bible, you name it. So we're living in weird times, Arnie.
I know. And even if I'm going to be deferential and, supportive, I don't think anybody out there, whether they're, true believers in this way of governance or they're not, would argue that this is completely unprecedented in the way the White House is operating now.
Completely.
Completely uncharted.
Back after these words. Arnie, we are joined with Tino Sonora, professor of finance at the University of Montana.
Hey, Tino, how are we doing today?
I'm doing fine, guys.
Good. This is our quarterly. I feel like I'm going to the doctor, the economic doctor. Every quarter, we check in with you to see, take the pulse of, the global economy, the U.S. economy, the Montana economy, Missoula, and to try to get your sage advice about where we are and more importantly, maybe where we're going.
Well, I appreciate it. And it's always fun to talk to you guys because you always, make me think a little bit. So that's always welcome.
So let's begin on a bigger picture basis. How's the U.S. economy doing? I mean, what I've seen is sort of a mixed signal out there. The GDP is a little bit lower, maybe a point lower, a little bit more than a point lower than it was in 2024 at this time. So over the past year, what's the effect of the tariffs been? Where do we sit in the bigger picture?
It's hard to say right now. I think right now the best thing I can say is we're kind of in a holding pattern. A lot of the policies have not kicked in yet. Certainly the policies that are part of the One Big Beautiful Bill have not, they're not part of the current data at all. And I'm kind of, well, I'm not kind of, I don't think the tariff stuff has really hit our data yet either. In the lead up to all the sort of tariff discussions and the on again, off again, on again, off again kind of discussion, a lot of firms built up some inventory, were able to sort of build up stuff to have around just when the tariffs hit. So that just helped keep inflation in check, even though it did tick up to 2.7% last month, year on year. So I don't think we're seeing that happen just yet. I think what we're going to start seeing, though, is once these tariffs really start hitting in a bigger way, we're going to start seeing some employment drop off because the costs of production are going to start to rise. It's going to take time for firms to relocate some of their intermediate services kinds of stuff and what they produce for intermediate goods. And they might not even, they're foregoing investment, which I think is going to have a longer term impact of slowing down growth over the foreseeable future. I mean, that's kind of my, if I were to look at it sort of from 30,000 feet, I mean, what I see as a pretty good possibility of happening is maybe not seeing a recession, but I do see a kind of a growth slowdown. So
Lower
the
growth.
1970s, the 1970s had a period of time where we had what we call the growth slowdown, rising energy prices, a little bit of consumer uncertainty, consumer sentiment was sort of falling, relatively high interest rates. I think with these tariffs, I mean, tariffs now are, what they guess. I mean, everything's kind of a guess still at this point, but
Tino, I have a question about that though. In a normal administration, because this is anything but normal, we know that. How long does it take for an administration, or how long does it take to actually formulate and put tariffs into place with respect to how do they determine what the tariffs would be? How long does it take to negotiate and to put a plan in place? Because my understanding is that everything's being compressed and is so random, but this is not the normal way that our
No,
countries work with each other.
exactly right. I mean, that's sort of like if I were to talk normal, the normal thing would be industry A, let's call it the steel industry, complains to the administration, whatever the administration is or the Congress, that Sweden is using unfair trade practices. They're subsidizing their steel exports. And so that's putting a sort of a global price of steel is dropping, which is forcing American steel producers to kind of deal with these lower global prices of steel and potentially putting, US steel out of business. So then what the United States would generally do is go before the WTO, the World Trade Organization, which is sort of like a court of arbitration for trade. And they would try to hash it out. And they would say, come on, Sweden, you guys have to stop subsidizing or stop subsidizing so much, or at the very least subsidize it, but don't charge lower than world prices kind of thing. And then in the United States, and then if that didn't work, then the WTO might come back to the United States and say, well, they're not willing to do it. The United States say, okay, we'll do some sort of retaliatory tariff. And usually it takes some time, right? And there's a lot of discussion about it and what the tariff rate should be and some lobbying and all this kind of stuff. So it usually comes from the industry level. Like we are complaining about unfair trade practices.
I see.
Now, these, I mean, some of these things can go on for years, and some of them get resolved relatively quickly. But I guess the most famous or infamous one that I could think of is the Banana Wars that began basically in the mid 1980s with the Europeans. I can't even remember the sort of birth of this. I think the Europeans were complaining about unfair trade practices of banana exports and what constitutes a banana, right? So I might have mentioned this before. Like is a banana sort of got like a 30 degree curvature on an arc, or is it like a 60 degree arc on the curvature of the fingers, is the sort of technical term. And so, if the fingers are too curved, then it's not a banana, and so we can't allow that into the country. So this actually sparked like a 30 or 40 year trade war, and it just went back and forth, back and forth. Obviously, the soft wood imports from Canada, where United States complains, or United States timber logging firms complained that provinces in Canada were unfairly subsidizing logging exports or timber exports, softwood timber exports, and that's been a trade war for years. But again, usually it's also just one industry. It's not like a blanket tariff. And I think the two things are most striking about this. First is just the generality of the tariffs. It's like we're not tariffing steel, we're tariffing Liechtenstein. We're not, whatever Liechtenstein produces, it's got a tariff. It doesn't matter if we have a trade surplus with Liechtenstein or not. It doesn't matter. In fact, of the 150 odd countries in the world, the United States has a trade deficit with about 40 of them. So we're charging tariffs on, we're raising tariffs against countries with which we have a trade surplus with them. The big ones that we have trade deficits with are, we have a trade deficit with, I don't even know, we have a trade deficit with China, the EU, Japan, places like that, but we have trade surpluses with most other of our trading partners, and so we're still slapping a tariff on them, right? Because the thing was, if you even if we have a trade surplus, we're going to slap a 10% tariff. And I use Australia as my example. We have a pretty sizable trade surplus with Australia, and we're tariffing Australia 10%. So what's basically happened is, because it's across the board, it's not just on steel, although obviously there's differentiations, right? We're tariffing not just Liechtenstein, but then if Liechtenstein produces steel, we're going to tack on additional tariffs on top of that. The average, apparently, this is the latest estimate that's coming out of the Yale Budget Lab. The average tariff rate is about 21% for the United States, which is the highest it's been since 1915 or whatever.
Well,
Um,
before all this craziness, the average tariff was 3.3%,
or or lower. Yeah, exactly.
and things were going pretty good.
Things were fine. Yeah.
I think most importantly for our listeners is we've done this before on the show, but I think it's important to clarify who bears the burden of
Right.
these additional tariffs.
Right.
The administration would like us to think that somehow it's punishing country of origin of where the product is produced.
Right.
Somehow they're going to absorb all of the cost associated.
Well, I mean, they are going to absorb some of them because they don't want to use the United States as a trading partner. I mean, the trading, the United States is the bull in the China shop kind of thing. And if the United States want to impose tariffs, and they don't want to lose that business because so much of their economy is sort of focused on the United States, they're not going to want to
Right.
lose that business. And so they will absorb. In fact, I was talking to a friend of mine here who's in the pipe industry business. So his company builds pipe and pipelines for natural gas and oil extraction. He's ordered a gigantic machine that does something, and they kind of knew when they were negotiating the price and everything, they tried to factor in the price of the tariffs, and they kind of had to go back and forth. And apparently that machine manufacturing, I want to say it's in Brazil, but don't quote me on that, is willing to absorb some of the cost. But you're absolutely right, he's going to have to pay some of it too. It just depends. So again, it gets a little bit technical about what it
Right,
is,
but
but let's just put it this way. The more of a necessity a good is, if it's a final good, mind you. Now, I'm not talking about intermediate goods, but even intermediate goods, but if it's a retail thing that consumers buy, then the consumer will pay a relatively high price. So, for example, if I'm buying a mattress from China, that's the final thing, right? So that is a final good. And when that thing gets a tariff, then yes, the consumer of the mattress pays a higher price, some fraction of the tariff.
right. For
But you've got
example,
to bear in mind that a lot of our tariffs are being imposed on intermediate goods, and what actually boils down to is how much of that intermediate good tax can be passed on to the consumer. The United States, we're relatively competitive, so if there's, again, $100 tax on a mattress that is a intermediate good, like let's say a mattress might be an intermediate good to a hotel, right? The final consumer of the mattress is not the hotel. The hotel buys the mattress, and then we sleep on it because we go visit the hotel. How much of that mattress price is going to then be transferred from the hotel onto the consumer is still a little bit fuzzy. So it just depends
Right.
on what that sort of tariff pass-through is from intermediate goods into final goods. But you're right, United States consumers, whether they be final goods consumers, like at the consumer level, or intermediate goods consumers, like at the manufacturing level, say,
Right.
They're going to have to pay a portion of it. Yeah.
I was at the Hyundai dealer 2 weeks ago,
Right.
and they were pushing people to buy what was in inventory
Right.
because they say their estimates are, on a $35,000 car, the consumer neck, once they start importing under the new tax imposed on Korea, South Korea,
Right.
they're going to pass $1,500 to $2,500 more on to the consumer.
Right.
It's going to cost you $2,500 more. In a state
Yeah.
where there's a local sales tax, you're talking about $3,000 more on a car,
Right. Right.
almost
Right.
10% more you're going to pay for the same
Right.
vehicle.
Yeah, you're paying a tax on top of the tax. And again, it's still too soon, I think, for us to really see just what the effects are going to be. I know it's starting now, and this is mainly at things that are very sort of 1 degree of separation away from the import. So, the bag of strawberries arrives in Long Beach, California, and then on Thursday it's, in Kroger's. Those
Right.
types of goods we're starting to see pretty quickly. But if you're looking at, what are the impacts of steel tariffs going to be on washing machine manufacturing, that might take some time to actually bleed through. And I guess the concern is going to be is those prices are going to start ramping up. We'll start, I suspect, we'll start seeing these prices ramping up. And I said this a few last time we chatted, I didn't think it was going to be immediate. July, August, September kind of thing is when I
Right.
think we'll start seeing it, but that's not going to be the end of it. But again, there's so much uncertainty.
Right.
We don't know
Well,
if these
what's
tariffs are going to stick around. We have a new night, I don't know, 50-day headline. I mean, every day it's a 50-day deadline.
But the market doesn't seem to flinch
Because the
anymore.
market finally, I think this is my thing. First and foremost, in April, when we talked in April,
Yep.
I think the market was taking Trump too seriously. And now I think the market has just said, I don't, what are they calling him, Taco, right? I think the market's just like, we'll believe it when we see it kind of thing. I think they're taking that kind of
I think that's
attitude.
an accurate assessment because as you mentioned before, the bull in the China shop, we are a huge customer to a lot of places in the world, and we do sell a lot of product to the world. And we are taking a totally generic formula. We're not applying it to the pressure points. It's like somebody has a bullet wound, right? And you're bandaging the whole body.
Right. Exactly.
There are products and industries where there needs to be trade negotiation because domestic product, like the Canadian situation, where the government subsidizes, their wood production, and so our prices aren't that competitive, so we have to make some slight adjustments. But
Right.
never in history, under a normal situation, do they just walk in and say, everybody pays 20%.
Right.
And somehow that's beneficial to who?
Yeah, I
I don't
mean,
get what it's supposed to do.
right. And I mean, I think we talked about this last time too, is my sort of, I have a couple different nuclear options, but we're gonna have to issue more debt because we're gonna see a whatever $5 trillion increase in the budget debt over the next 10 years, I think is the latest estimate, roughly 5 trillion. So the United States is gonna have to issue a lot more debt. We're going to have less dollars floating around in the rest of the world, which are then able to buy up that debt because now we have to have a trade surplus with everybody. So they actually have a double deficit, right? They're going to have a,
Right.
and what, as it turns out, is like for every dollar that leaves the United States, a dollar has to come back. So yeah, we have a trade deficit with Japan, but Japan buys a lot of our bonds. And when they buy our bonds, that pushes the price of those bonds up, which helps keeps our interest rates relatively moderated.
Right.
And what's going to happen is if that demand goes away, we're issuing more debt. We're starting to see inflation building because of the tariffs. The Fed is going to start reacting to higher rates of inflation. And by the way, that's another story which we can talk about a little bit later with Jerome Powell. But if the Fed starts seeing inflation building, they're going to want to raise rates. Bond yields are going to start rising. That's going to start pushing up mortgage rates again. I just was looking at the latest data. Mortgage rates are hovering at about 6.8%. For the best customers, right? So I mean, I see a situation where higher interest rates, lower trade, start slowing growth down. 1970s, 1 to 1.5% real GDP growth rate over the foreseeable future. If, again, there's so many ifs, if current policy stays the way it is.
Right.
But the policy could change.
What's striking to me about the policy is that the Republican Party historically has been the party of, we want a ceiling, we want, cut the deficit, we want all of these things. They're the party in power now, and they've sort of closed their eyes and pushed the yes button to a big, beautiful bill that's going to add $5 trillion to the debt and create all
Right.
of the things that you're saying.
Yeah, but the Republicans have never been a let's increase the deficit by increasing spending. That's what they claim is they're fiscally responsible. I mean, they're, I mean, most deficits grow during Republican, and that's because of the tax reforms.
Right.
And you know what's but what basically was happened is that everybody's living in a modern monetary theory world, right? MMT, where the Fed can issue debt, buy up the debt. I mean, that's the thing, what's going to happen, right? So people aren't going to buy up the debt from Japan or China or Mexico or Canada or Germany or wherever. You know, if the Fed starts monetizing the debt like it did during not only the financial crisis, but during COVID, we issued a lot of debt. The Fed monetized it, helped keep interest rates low. But that was a sort of a play against reductions in trying to keep consumer demand down and slow down, or keep up, I'm sorry, keep up consumer demand so that people keep buying stuff, so just to not push us into recession. But if they keep buying up debt, we have inflationary pressures building because of tariffs and the growing debt, and it's going to be a pretty tricky situation, and it's going to be a hard thing for the Fed to do. I mean, their balance sheet, their asset holdings of their balance sheet is off the charts, and it will only increase. But now what we're sort of living in is, as I said, is a modern monetary theory world whereby the government can issue as much debt as it wants. We can always say we'll just issue more debt to pay off current debtors, to pay off current creditors, and the Fed will pay it, will buy up that debt, and we'll just keep pushing this further and further into the future. Now, some economists might say, you know, yeah, that's fine. I mean, there is no reason. We're a big enough country. You know, if Greece were to do that, that would be problematic. But the United States can get away with it because people will buy our debt. But if now they don't have any money to buy our debt, it could be problematic.
What do you make of Trump threatening to fire, which he can't do, Jerome Powell? And why is he publicly, you know, calling him out about lowering the interest rate? Like, it's just so crude. What's the purpose of it?
He wants, this is a guess. I mean, I don't know. But my guess is he wants 3 to 4% real GDP growth. And he thinks that if we just lower interest rates, people are going to buy a lot of stuff and demand is going to go up, and we're going to hire a bunch of manufacturing workers to build all this stuff, and the economy is just going to hum along at some rate. The problem is, you know, today, even before all this policy was introduced, we have 10 million employment. Let me start. A shortage of 10 million people in manufacturing already.
Got
And a
it.
lot of the manufacturing people we're doing, we're sending them to, I don't know, to Everglades or to El Salvador, because a lot of the people, especially in food manufacturing, are immigrants.
Right.
Americans don't want to do that kind of stuff. So he wants this economy humming, but what's going to happen is you can't produce much more stuff instantaneously. The only thing that'll give is prices. And so what's, you know, ironically, his whole policy that of I'm going to get inflation in check, prices are going to be in check, we're going to produce more stuff. As far as I can tell, and I don't think I'm alone in this, most economists think that's just going to be very, very inflationary. And if he gets a guy in there, I mean, the Fed chairman is supposed to be completely independent. The Fed is supposed to be
Right.
independent of political, which is why they have 7-year terms, which is why they can, you know, they have to go through congressional process. They're supposed to be independent. And, you know, their eye is not on employment. You know, there's a kind of a joke about sexenios, which is the Mexican election cycle. You can sort of see what an election is by just looking at the unemployment rate. In year six, when the election is, the unemployment rate's really low, and then it kind of creeps up, and then in year
Right.
six, it goes back down again, right? So the Central Bank of Mexico is not independent enough that it can actually try to control inflation, and has to sort of go with what the political guys want. And you know, you see that all over the world. You know, in Croatia, they have what they call election roads, right? So when there's an election year, like all the roads get really good or get paved. Like one
Right.
year, there's nothing is being done, and the next year it's like, well, we want to get reelected, so let's build a new road. And so they have a name for it, election roads. And so I was riding my bike on election road today, or when I was in Croatia, you know, I was like, oh, this road just got paved. Well, it's an election road. You know, so that's the kind of stuff that happens. It's sort of Keynesian idea that if we just, you know, buy people off essentially, and then they'll reelect us. And but we, so my thing is I think Trump wants a puppet Fed chairman or person who will just do his bidding.
Yeah, and the deferred cuts in Medicaid. All designed after the midterms. It's all connected.
Political.
It's all
It's all
political.
political.
Politically gauged.
Well, and remember the first round of tax cuts under the Jobs Act of 2018, those tax cuts were set to expire when? In 2025 or 2026. Huh. So
Right.
guesstimating that the next president would, I don't know, be Biden, I guess, that he would get slammed with suddenly tax rates would go up.
Right. So let me switch the conversation to a little bit of a more local flavor. So one of the consequences of, beating up your trading partners is a reaction by the citizenry of those countries to the United States. So, for example, tourism is down in Montana from Canada and Mexico, as it is in Las Vegas. It's the two largest sections of people that go into a place like Las Vegas for tourism, and it's down by 7, 8, 9%. That's a lot of money. Montana, I hear along the border, all the places, Wilderness Club and other places that had a lot of Canadian tourists, now they're feeling the effects of it. And then recently, Trump has said there's going to be a new $250 tourist tax. Anybody that applies to come into the United States, even for tourism, has to pay $250. What's that going to do to a place like Montana that relies so heavily on tourism and a lot of international tourism?
Well, I mean, again, it depends on the fraction of tourists that are international. I mean, one of the sort of, I guess you could call it a positive externality of like COVID was that people quit traveling internationally and more Americans just traveled within their country. But you're right. I suspect that, well, let's see. So I know that the tourism, whatever, the National Tourism Association guesstimated that there's going to be about $25 billion loss in tourism activity. Places like Florida see a lot of Canadian tourists, and certainly Canadians come across the border to buy, washing machines. And I was reading a story, same thing. It's like I think it was in Washington State. This one business is basically almost gone because what was happening was Canadians were coming across the border, and then of course there was a retaliatory tax put on because we imposed a tariff on Canada. Canadian then did a retaliatory tax on imports back to Canada. And basically people were buying stuff in the store, and then the guy said, "Well, show me your receipt." And he's like, "Well, that's going to be $300 in taxes." And then people were like literally driving back to the store and like returning everything. And so
Right.
I mean, but yeah, I mean, there's a lot of that cross-border tourism that's just like back and forth. I don't know how that works. Is it gone? I mean, we have basically a passportless almost relationship with Canada. And so the impact, it's going to impact some parts really bad. Florida, I think, a lot of Canadians are going to start selling their condos. What's that going to do to the real estate market? I don't know. Canadians are selling their condos, and Mexicans are, in Florida too, I guess, California, wherever they have their stuff. So I think those kinds of markets are impacted. Iowa probably not so much. No offense against Iowa, but maybe some
Right.
agricultural stuff. Without a doubt, agriculture is going to have a pretty big impact. So it's not just going to be tourists. It's going to be across the board agriculture, and that's probably where we're going to feel it the strongest in Montana, is because of the agricultural exports. Because Canada is one of our largest our export markets. So, but they start retaliating. I mean, then we could just go down the road, and USAID shut down, and a lot of $5 billion of agricultural production went towards USAID to be sent abroad. So agriculture is going to take a hit, manufacturing could take a hit, transportation, tourism is going to take a hit. Who knows what's going to happen with energy? That's another thing. I mean, all of these things are going to take a hit. And I again, to me, it just adds up to a growth slowdown, I think. I really do.
And was any of this necessary?
Are there problems in the global economic system? Are there cheaters? Are there countries which are doing unfair trade practices? 100%. And 100% of the countries do. The United States does too. I mean, we all cheat in trade. We all cheat. Is it the best possible purists? Absolutely not. Is it the best system that we have for the United States? Yes. I mean, our trade relationships with the rest of the world were not developed like last year.
Right.
There's been trade negotiations that have been going on literally since the end of World War II, through countless rounds of trade negotiations. And it's hard for me to believe that over 80 years or whatever it's been since the end of World War II, that all of these American negotiators were acting in the United States' least best interest, right?
Right, that they were all, they lost all the negotiations.
Yeah, they, yeah, no, I mean, it's, you know, no, I mean, it's not possible. I mean, and I was talking, I think the last time I talked to you, I just seen, well, maybe not. In May, right before I left for Croatia, I was in Washington, D.C., for a conference, and my cousin was actually one of the, worked for Senator Bob Packwood, from Oregon, and basically helped write the NAFTA treaty. And a lot of these, and help sort of put together WTO. So it's like we have all these mechanisms in place, and people do have a place to complain, and we do have legitimate complaints. I mean, there are companies which do egregious things. There are, and I was not that anti going against China because of corporate espionage. The Chinese do a lot of corporate espionage. It's not no mystery there. I absolutely, you should go after those guys. But at the same time, if I can get steel that's better and cheaper from China, why would I do it here? It doesn't make sense. I mean, look, we don't, how many Chinese cars do you see on the road in the United States?
None.
Zero, because we don't let them import. How many US cars are on the roads in China? Quite a bit. But we don't allow Chinese cars here for whatever reason.
The biggest Buick production plant in the world is in Shanghai.
Right. And we don't there, you go to Europe and you see, these electric cars which, can drive themselves, fly to the moon and back, and people love them. But we can't buy them here because it's too, we have a trade restriction on Chinese exports of automobiles.
It's just bewildering that some what you were just describing. I mean, a company is cheating, or a company is doing espionage, or a company is stealing. So you sanction that company. You stop them from doing. You don't sanction the whole country
Right. You don't sanction the whole country and everything they produce.
and everything they produce. I mean, it's just
Right.
there's no logic. I mean, I don't even under the best circumstances. I don't know how that works out to a situation that was better than it was before. They're not going to tax anything from the United States that goes into their country, and then people are going to be so pissed off in the US they're not going to buy any US products.
Right. And
Yeah.
that's
So, I
what.
mean, I don't see how it works.
Right, and that's the Canadian thing, right? That they're basically saying they're voting with their feet, right? So they're gonna go, instead of going to Florida, I'm gonna go to Puerto Vallarta or whatever. Yeah, I mean, and certainly the Canadians and Mexicans are now probably talking a lot more closely with each other because we're all part of the USMCA, right? The United States,
And then
Mexico,
if you're a
Canadian Free Trade
smart,
Agreement.
Chinese negotiator, you go in and say, "Hey, I can get you this stuff. You haven't bought it from me before. You bought it from the US. We'll work a deal for you. We're not going to charge you those kind of tariffs. We
Right.
can make whatever you want."
Well, and there is, I think there, one of the things that's kind of growing concern, I think, in Europe, for example, is that because of American tariffs on Chinese exports, that those exports are going to be diverted to Europe, and that's going to actually start undermining European manufacturing. And so they're very concerned about being basically rushed a whole surplus of what would have come to the United States exports coming into Europe in the EU. And so now they're worried about protecting their own industries. And so you get these ripple-on effects. Now suddenly, the Europeans are retaliating against the United States and then imposing trade tariffs on Chinese imports because they want to protect their own industries. And then I guess the Chinese retaliate against that. And so, I mean, one of the main, well, we talked about this before, right? And one of the main causes of the Great Depression was the raising in Smoot-Hawley and all these tariffs causing a global slowdown. And Europe hasn't grown since the end of COVID. Italy this year, Italy returned to where it was during the financial crisis in terms of GDP.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, it sank and then it grew and then it sank some more and then it finally got back to where it is in 2008. Italy's lost, I was just listening to a story the other day. Italy's lost like I'm making this up, but it's close to like 20% of its population in the past 40 years.
Wow.
And so what are they going to do? I don't know. I don't
Right.
know what they're going to do. And the Germans haven't grown since the end of COVID. I mean, they have flat growth since the end of COVID. Zero growth.
Tino,
So they're concerned.
so let's switch gears for a second. So a new semester starts in a couple of weeks here in Missoula at the university. How is all that's happening here and what we've kind of talked about over the last certainly 200 days when we've checked in with you each quarter, how does that impact what goes on with what you're doing at the university? And I guess it puts everything into a sharp focus, I would think. But there's a lot more awareness of what's going on with our economy than maybe there would have been a year ago or 2 years ago. So tell us about the practical implications of this with what you do day to day.
Well, I mean, it depends on the department and the college. I mean, certainly because there's been a pullback in a lot of federal grant funding, parts of the university are being pretty negatively impacted by this, and there is concern that even though the money has already been given by Congress and has an expiration date of whatever,
Right.
they're freezing that money. And so there are people, and it's not just at UM, obviously in other research, not just universities, but research institutions around the country are worried about that pullback in grant money. And again, a lot of people planned on this, and they've made plans like I bought this machine, and now suddenly I can't afford it because, they just pulled my funding. I think too, again, this is not going to impact UM so much because we have a relatively small international cohort of students, but that's another what's going to happen next semester
Right.
for universities which have relatively large foreign component to them, a lot of foreign students. A friend of mine, he's at Brandeis University in Boston, and I'm like, I'm He's seeing like 75% of the revenues that Brandeis makes, and that's kind of a guesstimate, is from foreign students. A place like Brandeis, I don't know what they're going to do. Foreign students decide, I'd rather go to the UK or France or Australia or go to an American style university in, UAE or
What's
Turkey
even
or wherever.
worse, Tino, is they've put a freeze on student visas. You can't even come here. New students cannot come here to go to school.
There you go. So that's gonna that I mean for a place like Boston, which has a very large student population, even UM, which is we're not a big university, but relative to the size of Missoula, we're pretty big. And I don't
Yes.
know what the total population of foreign students is that come to University of Montana, but it's pretty it's not nothing, but
Right.
it's not giant, but it's not nothing either.
No.
Students come and they spend money. I mean, it's not the
There's
poor
over.
students from not the poor students from China come to the United States, right? It's guys that kind of drive around in M5s and stuff, and they spend money,
There's
right?
over a million foreign students going to colleges and universities in the United States.
Right.
If they shut that down for 4 years, you won't have any left here at all. You
Well,
have
you
a
might not
million
have any,
less.
and you might never get them back.
You might not ever get them back. And those students generally pay full ride or
Yep.
more to most of the schools.
Right.
So they're a very coveted, student, part of the student population. That's an awful lot
Exactly.
of
Well,
students.
you actually bring up another point, which is, and back to the tariffs for a second, is folks are bypassing the United States and they're trading with they're talking about how do they work with each other more Exactly.
effectively,
Exactly.
right? So does the same thing happen with higher education? Is
I
that
don't see why I wouldn't. I mean, do you want an English language degree? Great. UK,
Right.
obviously, Australia. But then there's a lot of universities. China's got English-only universities, right? And they
Yep.
have, professors trained in the United States. They have a, when I first finished up my PhD, I interviewed with a university in Turkey. It was basically like, we're like, think of us like, Northwestern, but in Turkey, right? Something like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
All of our classes are in English. All of our professors are American, UK, whatever. France has got a bunch of, especially like business schools, where English is the
Right.
primary language.
Let's not
Business
forget. Let's
schools,
not forget Canada. There's
Canada, of course.
tremendous
Yeah, I mean, really
universities
good
in Canada.
universities there. Yeah, and then it's also if you know, there's also now a market for American universities to go somewhere else. So. And then from a research perspective, you know, my big concern is, you know, the United States has a comparative advantage in producing new things, innovation, you know, whether it
Right.
be, you know, pharmaceuticals or high tech or software programming or whatever. And we export that. And what do we get with that? We get avocados and we get, you know, trips to Venice or whatever. But, you know, that's how the economy works is you don't, you know, I don't make avocados because I suck at it. And I don't have the right land to make avocados. So it's better for me to be a professor and then go out and buy avocados. And so again, I think for, you know, people have been sort of trying to put this into sort of more layman terms. And I think we mentioned this last time. It's like I have a trade deficit with Albertsons. I spend more money at Albertsons and Albertsons spends money with me. And somebody else has a trade deficit with me with, I guess, you know, professor services or whatever you want to
Right. They're
say.
paying for your classes and
Right. And they have a trade deficit with me. And then, you know, I give them some human capital, which is what they desire to have. And they have a trade deficit with me, but somebody has a trade, they have a trade surplus with somebody else. So I have a trade surplus with students or I have trade surplus with whoever. But I have a lot of trade deficits. And that, and that's, you know, and I borrow money so that I have a trade deficit with bank services. I borrow money because I want to buy a house and I don't want to buy the whole house. I don't want like the 2025 Sonora to bear the responsibility of paying for the 2035 Sonora, right? He's got to pay some of
Right.
that stuff too. So then I have kind of a, I'm taking away from future me, right, by borrowing, but I'm consuming now house, but I'm still borrowing from my future self.
So what's interesting about that, Tito, is that's a very good explanation of how the microcosm based on an individual operates in an economy. We have 350 million Tinos
Right.
that are living here, that are all doing that simultaneously
Right.
in this economy. And then we have policies that currently are being put into effect that are so broad-based and you know, there's no room for, you know, modulation for them, that certain segments of this 350 million people are going to be hit harder than others, whether it's taxes, whether it's deficits, whether it's credit card interest rates, whether it's, you know, not being able to buy more, you know, getting a mortgage. I mean, all these things have an effect on each one of these 350 million, you know, residents of the United States.
Yeah, and I mean all of these things, you know, for economists, you know, the price is king. Whatever the price is, it's the price of
Right.
avocados, it's the price of borrowing money, it's the price of whatever the price is. When you start slanting those prices and pushing prices that are advantageous to one group of sellers, say to another group, then you start tilting people's decision making, and you when you if you favor one group over another, you could end up in a very sort of inefficient kind of allocation of resources. So if we're not very good at making steel, I mean, why try and benefit steel producers? I'm not saying we're not, but I'm just using that as an example. Why benefit, why reward, if you will, people who are not very good at doing what they do with protection? I mean, you know, the classic example, you know, that I always kind of, you know, it's the Trabant, right? For the East German car. Right, it was
Right.
made out of cardboard. You know, they have the funny phrase, even only men of steel drive cars of paper. But the Trabant was a classic example. So you have like, what happens when you protect your automobile industry with relatively high tariffs? And so you build the Trabant, and you know, anybody go Googles a Trabant, right? It's basically a lawnmower with four seats, and it came in three colors, which were all of which were beautiful. But that's what you end up with. And the same, that's what you end up doing is you end up basically allocating resources in such a way. That you basically reward people who are bad at doing what they're doing. So if BM, you know, Trabant was an East German car, for those of you not who, if you don't remember, you know, or Skoda was a Czech car, right? Same thing. Or the Yugo, we had Yugos here in the United States, if you remember those back in the 80s.
Oh yeah,
You know,
sure.
those were
Well,
terrific cars.
I think the consequences of what you're talking about are simply this. There's a global economy. Jobs migrate and factories migrate, not because people are stealing your businesses is
Right.
because it makes economic sense to do that.
Right. Exactly.
So there weren't big US companies who had their business stolen from them. They opened plants in other countries for a lot of these industries because it was more efficient. You
It's
know,
more efficient. It's
you
exactly
could.
right. I mean, what, again, if we were like Montana, I mean, should we raise tariffs against green chili from New Mexico? I mean, we're not good at making green chili in Montana.
Right.
We don't have the terroir or whatever you want to call it for green chili, right? New Mexico makes good green. We make good other stuff, and we export that to New Mexico. But
We have great cherries and
we have
flatheads.
great
That's right.
cherries.
Yeah.
Let's do this. Let's take a quick break. Our guest is Robert Tino Sonori. He is the professor of finance at the University of Montana's College of Business. Back after these words. Arnie, we are back with our guest, Tino Sonora.
You know, to round out this discussion, there are two things I want you to briefly talk about. One is let's go back and talk about the Fed. And then secondly, let's talk about exchange rates because all these 200 countries in the world are trading with each other with about 100 different currencies or more. And that has a profound effect on all this. So give me your thoughts on those two issues.
Well, the first thing I got to mention is that all of this policy uncertainty that's come out and all this up and down stuff has really had an impact on the value of the dollar. The value of the dollar has shrunk 10 to 15% across a global basket of currencies since January. So that's a pretty sharp reduction. And again, this is going to be my segue into the Fed. That's going to start driving inflation because when the dollar weakens, that means it takes more dollars for us to buy an avocado from Mexico because it depreciates against the peso, driving more inflation. So if we talk about inflation from that perspective, so that's another piece of the inflation puzzle that we're not talking about. It's not just tariffs. So you kind of think of the depreciation of the currency also as a tax on our imports. So the Fed is going to keep a pretty strong eye on this because, again, the Fed wants to keep inflation, the core rate of inflation, which is all prices less food and energy prices. It wants that at 2%. And by the way, because food prices and energy prices have been falling, the actual rate of inflation is probably, and I haven't looked at the data recently, lower than the actual core rate of inflation. So, the Fed's in a sort of a tricky spot. And obviously, it's becoming kind of a political football right now, with threats of getting rid of Jerome Powell. Has he slipped up? Has the Fed slipped up in the past 5, 6 years, particularly with COVID? Yeah, absolutely. I think we all did. And I don't think it's just the Fed that's culpable in that. I think most people thought that inflation would be tamed relatively quickly and kind of got behind the eight ball. But we're in a situation where people have lost a little bit of confidence in the dollar, which is what's showing up. And that could be Fed policy, that's economic policy, policy uncertainties through the roof. And all that is reducing people's sort of belief in the strength of the dollar. And the dollar is the global currency, and that if we leave this primacy, we kind of get like a premium associated because every transaction is conducted in dollars for the most part. If we lose that, lose it to the euro, which I don't think will happen, but maybe to the yuan or something like that, then that could be
That's
problematic.
trouble.
Yeah.
Trouble in River City.
Right.
That's frightening.
As it
Welcome.
were.
Yeah.
Well, our Q3 update was quite sobering, Arnie. With
Yes.
Tino. Tino, we're going to touch base in Q4.
All
We'll
right.
find
So
a
that's another
date.
90 days, right? I'll be in Missoula then, I think. So
Good.
we could
We'll
do it in
have you in the
person.
studio. We'll touch it. Maybe it'll be less sobering at that time.
Let's hope so.
Yes.
Anyway, thank you
Thank
so
you. It's
much.
always
Thanks a
good to
lot.
talk to you.
Yeah, great to
Great,
talk.
thanks, guys. It's fun to talk to you as well. And it'll be another interesting, again, it'll be an
Yes.
extra interesting few months. So
All right, we'll see you. I'll see you around, Tino. See you next week, Arnie.
thank you for listening to What Do You Know?
I can't wait for the next show, Scott.
I'm excited too, Arnie. If you'd like to suggest a guest, send me an email at scottrichman@townsquaremedia.com. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to News Talk KGVO.
Blowing out your birthday candles should be easy, but if you have undiagnosed COPD, you may find yourself short of breath. Early diagnosis and treatment can add years to your life. If you have symptoms like wheezing or chronic cough, talk to your doctor and visit copdfoundation.org today.